love with the life of a cook. She loved the crazy hours, the intensity of the work, the beauty of the product. She loved the deep stillness that underlay the din. A good crew was like an elective family in which everyone in the little hot world of the kitchen stood on equal footing, and every cook had weirdnesses concealed in her past or in his character, and even in the midst of the most sweaty togetherness, each family member enjoyed privacy and autonomy. She loved this. Susie Sterling's father, Ed, had given Susie and Denise several lifts into Manhattan before the night in August, when Denise was biking home and almost rode right into him where he stood by his BMW, smoking a Dunhill and hoping that she might come by alone. Ed Sterling was an entertainment lawyer. He pleaded inability to live without Denise. She hid her borrowed bike in some bushes by the road. That the bike was stolen by the time she came back for it the next day, and that she swore to its owner that she'd chained it to the usual post, ought to have given her fair warning of the territory she was entering. But she was excited by what she did to Sterling, by the dramatic hydraulic physiology of his desire. And when she returned to school in September, she decided that a liberal arts college did not compare well to a kitchen. She didn't see the point of working hard on papers that only a professor ever saw. She wanted an audience. She also resented that the college was making her feel guilty about her privileges while granting certain lucky identity groups plenary indulgences from guilt. She felt guilty enough already, thank you. Almost every Sunday, she took the cheap, slow proletarian combo of SEPTA and New Jersey Transit to New York. She put up with Ed Sterling's paranoid one-way telephone communications and his last-minute postponements and his chronic distraction and his jaw-taxing performance anxieties and her own shame at being taken to cheap ethnic restaurants in Woodside and Elmhurst and Jackson Heights so as not to be seen by anyone Sterling knew because, as he told her often, running both hands through his mink-thick hair, he knew everybody in Manhattan. While her lover teetered closer to utter freak-out and inability to see her anymore, Denise ate Uruguayan T-bones, Sino-Colombian tamales, thumbnail crayfish and red Thai curry, and alder-smoked Russian eels. Beauty or excellence, as typified for her by memorable food, could redeem almost any humiliation. But she never stopped feeling guilty about the bike. Her insistence that she'd chained it to the usual post. The third time she got involved with a man twice her age, she married him. She was determined not to be a squishy liberal. She'd quit school and worked to save money for a year, had taken 6 months in France and Italy, and had returned to Philly to cook at a thronged fish and pasta place off Catherine Street. As soon as she'd picked up some skills, she offered her services at Café Louche, which was then the most exciting place in town. Émile Berger hired her on the spot on the basis of her knife work and her looks. Within a week, he was complaining to her about the borderline competence of every person in his kitchen except her and him. Arrogant, ironic, devoted Émile became her asylum. She felt infinitely adult with him. He said he'd had enough of marriage his first time around, but he obligingly took Denise to Atlantic City and, in the words of the Barbera d'Alba she'd been drunk on when she proposed to him, made an honest woman of her. At Café Louche, they worked like partners, experience flowing from his head into hers. They sneered at their pretentious old rival, Le Bec Fin. They impulse bought a three-story townhouse on Federal Street in a mixed black and white and Vietnamese neighborhood near the Italian market. They talked about flavor the way Marxists talked about revolution. When Emile had finally taught her everything he would ever teach her, she tried to teach him a thing or two, like, let's freshen up the menu, how about? Let's maybe try that with a vegetable stock and a little bit of cumin, how about? And ran smack into that wall of irony and iron-clad opinion that she'd loved as long as she was on the happy side of it. She felt more skilled and ambitious and hungry than her white-haired husband. She felt as if, while working and sleeping and working and sleeping, she'd aged so rapidly that she'd passed Emile and caught up with her parents. Her circumscribed world of round-the-clock domestic and workplace togetherness seemed to her identical to her parents' universe of two. She had old-person aches in her young hips and knees and feet. She had scarred old-person hands. She had a dry old-person vagina. She had old-person prejudices and old-person politics. She had an old-person dislike of young people and their consumer electronics and their diction. She said to herself, "I'm too young to be so old." Whereupon her banished guilt came screaming back up out of its cave on vengeful wings, because Emile was as devoted to her as ever, as faithful to his unchanging self, and she was the one who'd insisted they get married. By amicable agreement, she left his kitchen and signed on with a competitor, Ardenne, which needed a sous chef and which, in her opinion, was superior to Café Louche in all things except the art of being excellent without seeming to try. Unperspiring virtuosity was undeniably Emile's great gift. At Ardenne, she conceived a desire to strangle the young woman who prepped and held down Garde-Manger. The woman, Becky Hemmerling, was a Culinary Institute grad with wavy blonde hair and a petite flat body and fair skin that turned scarlet in the kitchen heat. Everything about Becky Hemmerling sickened Denise. Her CIA education — Denise was an autodidact snob — her overfamiliarity with more senior cooks, especially with Denise, her vocal adoration of Jodie Foster, the stupid fish and bicycle texts on her T-shirts, her overuse of the word fucking as an intensifier, her self-conscious lesbian solidarity with the Latinos and Asians in the kitchen, her generalizations about right-wingers and Kansas and Peoria, her facility with phrases like men and women of color, the whole bright aura of entitlement that came of basking in the approval of educators who wished that they could be as marginalized and victimized and free of guilt as she was. "What is this person doing in my kitchen?" Denise wondered. Cooks were not supposed to be political. Cooks were the mitochondria of humanity. They had their own separate DNA. They floated in a cell and powered it, but were not really of it. Denise suspected that Becky Hemmerling had chosen the cooking life to make a political point, to be one tough chick, to hold her own with the guys. Denise loathed this motivation all the more for harboring a speck of it herself. Hemmerling had a way of looking at her that suggested that she, Hemmerling, knew her better than she knew herself, an insinuation at once infuriating and impossible to refute. Lying awake beside Emile at night, Denise imagined squeezing Hemmerling's neck until her blue eyes bugged out. She imagined pressing her thumbs into Hemmerling's windpipe until it cracked. Then one night she fell asleep and dreamed that she was strangling Becky and that Becky didn't mind. Becky's blue eyes, in fact, invited further liberties. The strangler's hands relaxed and traveled up along Becky's jawline and past her ears to the soft skin of her temples. Becky's lips parted and her eyes fell shut as if in bliss, as the strangler stretched her legs out on her legs and her arms out on her arms. Denise couldn't remember being sorrier to wake from a dream. "If you can have this feeling in a dream," she said to herself, "it must be possible to have it in reality." As her marriage foundered, as she became for Emile one more flashy, trend-chasing crowd-pleaser from Ardennes, and as he became for her the parent she betrayed with every word she spoke or swallowed, she took comfort in the idea that her trouble with Emile was his gender. This idea dulled the edge of her guilt. It got her through the terrible announcement she had to make. It got Emile out the door. It propelled her through an incredibly awkward first date with Becky Hemmerling. She glommed on to the belief that she was gay. She held it close and thereby spared herself just enough guilt that she could let Emile be the one to leave the house. She could live with buying him out and staying. She could allow him that moral advantage. Unfortunately, as soon as he was gone, Denise had second thoughts. She and Becky enjoyed a lovely and instructive honeymoon, and then began to fight, and fight, and fight. Their fighting life, like the sex life that so briefly preceded it, was a thing of ritual. They fought about why they were fighting so much, whose fault it was. They fought in bed late at night. They drew on unguessed reservoirs of something like libido. They were hung over from fighting in the morning. They fought their little brains out. Fought, fought, fought. Fought on the stairway, fought in public, fought on car seats. And although they got off regularly, climaxed in red-faced screaming fits, slammed doors, kicked walls, collapsed in wet-faced paroxysms, the lust for combat was never gone for long. It bound them together, overcame their mutual dislike. As a lover's voice or hair or curving hip keeps triggering the need to stop everything and fuck, so Becky had a score of provocations that reliably sent Denise's heart rate through the roof. The worst was her contention that Denise, at heart, was a liberal collectivist pure lesbian, and was simply unaware of it. "You're so unbelievably alienated from yourself," Becky said. "You are obviously a dyke. You obviously always were." "I'm not anything," Denise said. "I'm just me." She wanted, above all, to be a private person, an independent individual. She didn't want to belong to any group, let alone a group with bad haircuts and strange, resentful clothing issues. She didn't want a label, she didn't want a lifestyle, and so she ended where she'd started, wanting to strangle Becky Hemmerling. She was lucky, from a guilt management perspective, that her divorce was in the works before she and Becky had their last unsatisfying fight. Emil had moved to Washington to run the kitchen at the Hotel Bellinger for a ton of money. The weekend of tears, when he returned to Philly with a truck and they divided their worldly goods and packed up his share of them, was long past by the time Denise decided, in reaction to Becky, that she wasn't a lesbian after all. She left Ardennes and became chef at Mare Scuro, a new Adriatic seafood place. For a year she turned down every guy who asked her for a date, not just because she wasn't interested. They were waiters, purveyors, neighbors, but because she dreaded being seen in public with a man. She dreaded the day Emil found out, or the day she had to tell him, lest he find out accidentally, that she'd fallen for another man. It was better to work hard and see nobody. Life, in her experience, had a kind of velvet luster. You looked at yourself from one perspective, and all you saw was weirdness. Move your head a little bit, though, and everything looked reasonably normal. She believed she couldn't hurt anybody as long as she was only working. On a bright morning in May, Brian Callahan came by her house on Federal Street in his old Volvo station wagon, which was the color of pistachio ice cream. If you were going to buy an old Volvo, pale green was the color to get, and Brian was the kind of person who wouldn't buy a vintage car in any but the best color. Now that he was rich, of course, he could have had any car he wanted custom painted, but like Denise, Brian was the kind of person who considered this cheating. When she got in the car, he asked if he could blindfold her. She looked at the black bandana he was holding. She looked at his wedding ring. "Trust me," he said. "It's worth being surprised by." Even before he'd sold Eigen Melody for $19.5 million, Brian had moved through the world like a golden retriever. His face was meaty and less than handsome, but he had winning blue eyes and sandy hair and little boy freckles. He looked like what he was, a former Haverford lacrosse player and basically decent man to whom nothing bad had ever happened and whom you therefore didn't want to disappoint. Denise let him touch her face. She let his big hands get in her hair and tie the knot, let him disable her. The wagon's engine sang of the work involved in propelling a chunk of metal down a road. Brian played a track from a girl group album on his pull-out stereo. Denise liked the music, but this was no surprise. Brian seemed intent on playing and saying and doing nothing that she didn't like. For 3 weeks, he'd been phoning her and leaving low-voiced messages. "Hey, it's me." She could see his love coming like a train, and she liked it. Was vicariously excited by it. She didn't mistake this excitement for attraction. Hemmerling, if she'd done nothing else, had made Denise suspicious of her feelings, but she couldn't help rooting for Brian in his pursuit of her. And she'd dressed this morning accordingly. The way she'd dressed was hardly even fair. Brian asked her what she thought of the song. "Eh," she shrugged, testing the limits of his eagerness to please. "It's okay." "I'm fairly stunned," he said. "I was pretty sure you'd love this." "Actually, I do love it." She thought, "What is my problem?" They were on bad road with stretches of cobblestone. They crossed railroad tracks and an undulating stretch of gravel. Brian parked. "I bought the option on this site for $1, he said. "If you don't like it, I'm out a buck." She put her hand to the blindfold. "I'm going to take this off." "No, we're almost there." He gripped her arm in a legitimate way and led her across warm gravel and into shadow. She could smell the river, feel the quiet of its nearness, its sound-swallowing liquid reach. She heard keys and a padlock, the squawk of heavy-duty hinges. Cold industrial air from a pent-up reservoir flowed over her bare shoulders and between her bare legs. The smell was of a cave with no organic content. Brian led her up 4 flights of metal stairs, unpadlocked another door, and led her into a warmer space where the reverb had train station or cathedral grandeur. The air tasted of dry molds that fed on dry molds, that fed on dry molds. When Brian unblinded her, she knew immediately where she was. The Philadelphia Electric Company in the 70s had decommissioned its dirty coal power plants, majestic buildings like this one just south of Center City that Denise slowed down to admire whenever she drove by. The space was bright and vast. The ceiling was 60 feet up, and Chartres-like banks of high windows punctuated the northern and southern walls. The concrete floor had been serially repatched and deeply gouged by materials even harder than itself. It was more like a terrain than a floor. In the middle of it were the exoskeletal remains of 2 boiler and turbine units that looked like house-sized crickets stripped of limbs and feelers. Eroded black electromotive oblongs of lost capability. At the river end of the space were giant hatches where the coal had come in and the ashes had gone out. Traces of absent chutes and ducts and staircases brightened the smoky walls. Denise shook her head. "You can't put a restaurant in here."
"I was afraid you'd say that."
"You're going to lose your money before I have a chance to lose it myself."
"I might get some bank funding, too."
"Not to mention the PCBs and asbestos we're inhaling as we speak."
"There you're wrong," Brian said. "This place wouldn't be available if it qualified for Superfund money. Without Superfund money, Pico can't afford to tear it down. It's too clean."
"Bummer for Pico." She approached the turbines, loving the space regardless of its suitability. The industrial decay of Philadelphia, the rotting enchantments of the workshop of the world, the survival of mega-ruins in micro-times. She recognized the mood from having been born into a family of older people who kept mothballed wool and iron things in ancient boxes in the basement. She'd gone to school in a bright modernity and come home every day to an older, darker world. "You can't heat it, you can't cool it," she said. "It's a utility bill nightmare." Brian, Retriever, watched her intently. "My architect says we can run a floor along the entire south wall of windows, come out about 50 feet, glass it in on the other 3 sides, put the kitchen underneath, steam clean the turbines, hang some spots, and let the main space just be itself."
"This is so totally a money pit."
"Notice there aren't any pigeons," Brian said. "No puddles."
"But figure a year for the permits, another year to build, another year to get inspected. That's a long time to pay me for nothing." Brian replied that he was aiming for a February opening.
He had architect friends and contractor friends, and he foresaw no trouble with L&I, the dreaded city office of licenses and inspections. "The commissioner," he said, "is a friend of my dad's. They golf every Thursday." Denise laughed. Brian's ambition and competence, to use a word of her mother's, tickled her. She looked up at the arching tops of the windows. "I don't know what kind of food you think is going to work in here."
"Something decadent and grand. That's your problem to solve."
When they returned to the car, the greenness of which was of a piece with the weeds around the empty gravel lot, Brian asked if she'd made plans for Europe.
"You should take at least 2 months," he said. "I have an ulterior motive here."
"Yes?"
"If you go, then I can go for a couple of weeks myself. I want to eat what you eat. I want to hear how you think."
He said this with disarming self-interest. Who wouldn't want to travel in Europe with a pretty woman who knew her food and wine? If you, not he, were the lucky devil who got to do it, he would be as delighted for you as he expected you now to be delighted for him. This was his tone. The part of Denise that suspected she might have better sex with Brian than she'd had with other men, the part of her that recognized her own ambition in him, agreed to take 6 weeks in Europe and connect with him in Paris. The other, more suspicious part of her said, "When am I going to meet your family?"
"How about next weekend? Come out and see us at Cape May."
Cape May, New Jersey, consisted of a core of over-decorated Victorians and fashionably shabby bungalows surrounded by new printed circuit tracts of vile boom. Naturally, being Brian's parents, the Callahans owned one of the best old bungalows. Behind it was a pool for early summer weekends when the ocean was cold. Here, Denise, arriving late on a Saturday afternoon, found Brian and his daughters lounging while a mouse-haired woman, covered with sweat and rust, attacked a wrought-iron table with a wire brush. Denise had expected Brian's wife to be ironic and stylish and something of a knockout. Robin Passafaro was wearing yellow sweatpants, an MAB paint cap, a Phillies jersey of unflattering redness, and terrible glasses. She wiped her hand on her sweats and gave it to Denise. Her greeting was squeaky and oddly formal. "It's very nice to meet you." She went immediately back to work. "I don't like you either," Denise thought. Sinead, a skinny, pretty girl of 10, was sitting on the diving board with a book in her lap. She waved carefully at Denise. Erin, a younger and chunkier girl wearing headphones, was hunched over a picnic table with a scowl of concentration. She gave a low whistle.
"Erin's learning bird calls," Brian said.
"Why?"
"Basically, we have no idea."
"Magpie," Erin announced. "Quag, quag, quag, quag."
"This might be a good time to put that away," Brian said.
Erin peeled off her headphones, ran to the diving board, and tried to bounce her sister off it. Sinead's book nearly went into the soup. She snagged it with an elegant hand.
"Dad!"
"Honey, it's a diving board, not a reading board."
There was a coked-up fast-forwardness to Robin's brushing. Her work seemed pointed and resentful, and it set Denise's nerves on edge. Brian, too, sighed and considered his wife.
"Are you almost done with that?"
"Do you want me to stop?"
"That would be nice, yes."
"Okay."
Robin dropped the brush and moved toward the house.
"Denise, can I get you something to drink?"
"Glass of water, thanks."
"Erin, listen," Sinead said. "I'll be a black hole and you'll be a red dwarf."
"I want to be a black hole," Erin said.
"No, I'm the black hole. The red dwarf runs around in circles and gradually gets sucked in by powerful gravitational forces. The black hole sits here and reads."
"Do we collide?" Erin said.
"Yes," Brian interposed, "but no information about the event ever reaches the outside world. It's a perfectly silent collision." Robin reappeared in a black one-piece swimsuit. With a gesture just short of rude, she gave Denise her water.
"Thank you," Denise said.
"You're welcome,"
Robin said. She took off her glasses and dove into the deep end.
She swam underwater while Aaron circled the pool and emitted shrieks appropriate to a dying M or S class star. When Robin surfaced at the shallow end, she looked naked in her semi-blindness. She looked more like the wife Denise had imagined, hair pouring in rivers down her head and shoulders, her cheekbones and dark eyebrows gleaming. As she left the pool, water beaded on the hemming of her suit and streamed through the untended hairs of her bikini line. An old, unresolved confusion gathered like asthma in Denise. She felt a need to get away and cook.
"I stopped at the necessary markets," she told Brian. "It doesn't seem fair to put our guest to work," he said. "On the other hand, I offered, and you're paying me."
"There is that, yes."
"Aaron, now you be a pathogen," Sinead said, slipping into the water, "and I'll be a leukocyte."
Denise made a simple salad of red and yellow cherry tomatoes. She made quinoa with butter and saffron, and halibut steaks with a color guard of mussels and roasted peppers. She was nearly done before she thought to peer under the foil coverings of several containers in the refrigerator. Here she found a tossed salad, a fruit salad, a platter of cleaned ears of corn, and a pan of, could it be, pigs in blankets? Brian was drinking a beer by himself on the deck.
"There's dinner in the fridge," Denise told him. "There's already a dinner."
"Yikes," Brian said. "Robin must have, I guess, when the girls and I were out fishing."
"Well, there's a whole dinner there. I just made a second whole dinner."
Denise laughed, really angry.
"Do you guys not communicate?"
"No, in fact, this was not our most communicative day. Robin had some work at the garden project that she wanted to stay and do. I had to kind of drag her over here."
"Well, fuck."
"Look," Brian said, "we'll have your dinner now, and we can have hers tomorrow. This is totally my fault."
"I guess."
She found Robin on the other porch, cutting Aaron's toenails.
"I just realized," she said, "that I've been making dinner and you already made it. Brian didn't tell me."
Robin shrugged.
"Whatever." "No, I'm really sorry about this, though."
"Whatever," Robin said.
"The girls are excited that you're cooking."
"I'm sorry."
"Whatever."
At dinner, Brian prodded his shy progeny to answer Denise's questions. Each time she caught the girls staring at her, they lowered their eyes and reddened. Sinead, in particular, seemed to know the right way to want her. Robin ate quickly with her head down and declared the food tasty. It wasn't clear how much her unpleasantness was aimed at Brian and how much at Denise. She went to bed soon after the girls, and in the morning she had already left for Mass when Denise got up. "Quick question," Brian said, pouring coffee. "How would you feel about driving me and the girls back to Philly tonight? Robin wants to get back to the garden project early." Denise hesitated. She felt positively shoved by Robin into Brian's arms.
"Not a problem if you don't want to," he said. "She's willing to take a bus and leave us the car."
"A bus? A bus?"
Denise laughed.
"Sure, now I'll drive you."
She added, echoing Robin,
"Whatever."
At the beach, as the sun burned off the metallic morning coastal clouds, she and Brian watched Aaron veer through the surf while Sinead dug a shallow grave.
"I'll be Jimmy Hoffa," Sinead said, "and you guys be the mob."
They worked to inter the girl in sand, smoothing the cool curves of her burial mound, thumping the hollows of the living body underneath. The mound was geologically active and was experiencing little quakes, webs of fissure spreading where Sinead's belly rose and fell.
"I'm just now putting it together," Brian said, "that you are married to Emile Berger."
"Do you know him?"
"Not personally, but I knew Café Louche. Ate there often."
"That was us.
Two awfully big egos in a little kitchen."
"Yeah."
"Do you miss him?"
"My divorce is the great unhappiness of my life."
"That's an answer," Brian said, "but not to my question."
Sinead was destroying her sarcophagus slowly from within, toes wriggling into daylight, a knee erupting, pink fingers sprouting from moist sand. Aaron flung herself into a slurry of sand and water, picked herself up, and flung herself back down again.
I could get to like these girls, Denise thought.
At home that night, she called her mother and listened, as she did every Sunday, to Enid's litany of Alfred's sins against a healthy attitude, against a healthful lifestyle, against doctor's orders, against circadian orthodoxies, against established principles of daytime verticality, against common-sense rules regarding ladders and staircases, against all that was fun-loving and optimistic in Enid's nature. After 15 grueling minutes, Enid concluded,
"Now, and how are you?"
Since her divorce, Denise had resolved to tell her mother fewer lies, and so she made herself come clean about her enviable travel plans. She omitted only the fact that she would travel in France with someone else's husband. This fact already radiated trouble.
"Oh, I wish I could go with you," Enid said. "I so love Austria."
Denise manfully offered, "Why don't you take a month and come over?"
"Denise, there's no way could I leave Dad by himself.
He can come, too.
You know what he says. He's given up on land tours. He has too much trouble with his legs. So you just go and have a wonderful time for me. Say hello to my favorite city, and be sure and visit Cindy Meisner. She and Klaus have a chalet in St. Moritz and a huge, elegant apartment in Vienna."
To Enid, Austria meant the Blue Danube and Edelweiss. The music boxes in her living room, with their floral and alpine marquetry, all came from Vienna. Enid was fond of saying that her mother's mother had been Viennese, because this was a synonym in her mind for Austrian, by which she meant of or relating to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. An empire that, at the time of her grandmother's birth, had encompassed lands from north of Prague to south of Sarajevo. Denise, who as a girl had had a massive crush on Barbara Streisand in Yentl, and who as a teenager had steeped herself in I.B. Singer and Shalom Aleichem, once badgered from Enid an admission that the grandmother in question might in fact have been Jewish, which, as she pointed out in triumph, would make both her and Enid Jewish by direct matrilineal descent. But Enid, quickly backpedaling, said that no, her grandmother had been Catholic. Denise had a professional interest in certain flavors from her grandmother's cooking. Country ribs and fresh sauerkraut, gooseberries and whortleberries, dumplings, trouts and sausages. The culinary problem was to make Central European heartiness palatable to size four petites. The titanium card crowd didn't want Wagnerian slabs of Sauerbraten or softballs of Semmelknödel or Alps of Schlag. This crowd might, however, eat sauerkraut. If ever there was a food for chicks with toothpick legs, low-fat and high-flavor and versatile, ready to fall in bed with pork, with goose, with chicken, with chestnuts, ready to take a raw plunge with mackerel, sashimi, or smoked bluefish, severing her last ties with Mare Scuro, she flew to Frankfurt as a salaried employee of Brian Callahan with a no-limit American Express card. In Germany, she drove 100 miles an hour and was tailgated by cars flashing their high beams. In Vienna, she looked for a Vienna that didn't exist. She ate nothing that she couldn't have done better herself. One night, she had Wiener Schnitzel and thought, "Yes, this is Wiener Schnitzel, uh-huh." Her idea of Austria was way more vivid than Austria itself. She went to the Kunsthistorisches Museum and the Philharmonic. She reproached herself for being a bad tourist. She got so bored and lonely that she finally called Cindy von Kippel, née Meisner, and accepted an invitation to dinner at her 17-room apartment on the Ringstrasse. Cindy had gone thick around the middle and looked, Denise thought, far worse than she had to. Her features were lost in foundation, rouge, and lipstick. Her black silk pants were roomy in the hips and tight at the ankles. Brushing cheeks and weathering the tear gas attack of Cindy's perfume, Denise was surprised to detect bacterial breath. Cindy's husband, Klaus, had yard-wide shoulders, narrow hips, and a butt of fascinating tininess. The von Kippel living room was half a block long and furnished with gilt chairs in sociability-killing formations.
Ancestral Watoari hung on the walls, as did Klaus's Olympic bronze medal, mounted and framed beneath the largest chandelier.
"What you see here is merely a replica," Klaus told Denise. "The original medal is in safe storage."
On a Louis XIV-ish sideboard was a plate of bread discs, a mangled smoked fish with the consistency of chunk-canned tuna, and a not-large piece of Emmentaler. Klaus took a bottle from a silver bucket and poured Sekt with a flourish.
"To our culinary pilgrim," he said, raising a glass. "Welcome to the holy city of Wien."
The Sekt was sweet and over-carbonated and remarkably much like Sprite.
"It's so neat you're here," Cindy cried.
She snapped her fingers frantically, and a maid hurried in through a side door.
"Anerl, hon," Cindy said in a more babyish voice. "Remember I said use the rye bread, not the white bread?"
"Yes, madame," the middle-aged Anerl said.
"So it's sort of too late now, because I meant this white bread for later, but I'd really wish you'd take this back and bring us the rye bread instead. And then maybe send someone out for more white bread for later."
Cindy explained to Denise.
"She's so sweet, but so, so silly. Aren't you, Anerl? Aren't you a silly thing?"
"Yes, madame."
"Well, you know what it's like. You're a chef," Cindy told Denise as Anerl exited. "It's probably even worse for you, the stupidity of people."
"The arrogance and stupidity," Klaus said.
"Tell somebody what to do," Cindy said, "and they just go do something else. It's so frustrating, so frustrating."
"My mother sends her greetings," Denise said.
"Your mom is so neat. She was always so nice to me. Klaus, you know the tiny, tiny little house my family used to live in a long time ago when I was a tiny, tiny little girl? Well, Denise's parents were our neighbors. My mom and her mom are still good friends. I guess your folks are still in their little old house, right?"
Klaus gave a harsh laugh and turned to Denise.
"Do you know what I really hate about St. Jude?"
"No," Denise said. "What do you really hate about St. Jude?"
"I really hate the phony democracy. The people in St. Jude pretend they're all alike. It's all very nice, 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 nice. But the people are not all alike, not at all. There are class differences, there are race differences, there are enormous and decisive economic differences, and yet nobody's honest in this case. Everybody pretends. Have you noticed this?"
"Do you mean..." Denise said, "like the differences between my mom and Cindy's mom?"
"No, I don't know your mother."
"Klaus, actually," Cindy said, "actually, you did meet her 3 Thanksgivings ago at the open house, remember?"
"Well, you see, everybody's the same," Klaus explained. "That's what I'm telling you. How can you distinguish the people when everybody pretends to be the same?"
Anerl came back with the dismal plate and different bread.
"Here, try some of this fish," Cindy urged Denise. "Isn't this champagne wonderful? Really different. Klaus and I used to drink it drier, but then we found this and we love it."
"There's a snob appeal to the dry," Klaus said, "but those who really know their Sekt know this emperor, this extra trocken, is quite naked."
Denise crossed her legs and said,
"My mother tells me you're a doctor."
"Yeah, sports medicine," Klaus said.
"All the best skiers come to Klaus," Cindy said.
"This is how I repay my debt to society," Klaus said.
Though Cindy begged her to stay, Denise escaped from the Ringstrasse before 9 and escaped from Vienna the next morning, heading east across the haze-white valley of the Middle Danube. Conscious of spending Brian's money, she worked long days, walking Budapest sector by sector, taking notes at every meal, checking out bakeries and tiny stalls and cavernous restaurants rescued from the brink of terminal neglect. She traveled as far east as Ruthenia, the birthplace of Enid's father's parents, now a Transcarpathian smidgen of the Ukraine. In the landscapes she traversed, there was no trace of shtetl. No Jews to speak of in any but the largest cities. Everything as durably, drably Gentile as she'd reconciled herself to being. The food, by and large, was coarse. The Carpathian highlands, everywhere scarred with the stab wounds of coal and pitch-blende mining, looked suitable for burying lime-sprinkled bodies in mass graves.
Denise saw faces that resembled her own, but they were closed and prematurely weathered. Not a word of English in their eyes. She had no roots. This was not her country. She flew to Paris and met Brian in the lobby of the Hôtel de Desiles. In June he'd spoken of bringing his whole family, but he'd come alone. He was wearing American khakis and a very wrinkled white shirt. Denise was so lonely, she almost jumped into his arms. What kind of idiot, she wondered, lets her husband go to Paris with a person like me? They ate dinner at La Cuillère Curieuse, a Michelin two-star establishment that, in Denise's opinion, was trying too hard. She didn't want raw yellowtail or papaya confit when she came to France. On the other hand, she was plenty sick of goulash. Brian, deferring to her judgment absolutely, made her choose the wine and order both dinners. Over coffee, she asked him why Robin hadn't come along to Paris. "It's the first zucchini harvest at the garden project," he said, with uncharacteristic bitterness. "Travel is a chore for some people," Denise said. "It didn't used to be for Robin," Brian said. "We used to take great trips all over the West. And now that we can really afford it, she doesn't want to go. It's like she's on strike against money." "It must be a shock, suddenly having so much." "Look, I just want to have fun with it," Brian said. "I don't want to be a different person, but I'm not going to wear sackcloth either." "Is that what Robin is doing?" "She hasn't been happy since the day I sold the company." Let's get an egg timer, Denise thought, and see how long this marriage lasts. She waited in vain as they walked the length of the quay after dinner for Brian to brush her hand with his. He kept looking at her hopefully, as if to be sure she had no objection to his stopping at this store window or veering down that side street. He had a happy canine way of seeking approval without seeming insecure. He described his plans for the generator as if it were a party that he was almost certain she would enjoy, clearly convinced, in the same way, that he was doing a good thing that she wanted. He backed away from her hygienically when they parted for the night in the lobby of the Desiles. She endured 10 days of his affability. Toward the end, she couldn't stand to see herself in mirrors. Her face seemed to her so ravaged, her tits so droopy, her hair such a frizzball, her clothes so traveled out. She was, basically, shocked that this unhappy husband was resisting her. Even though he had good reason to resist her, he being the father of two lovely girls, and she being, after all, his paid employee. She respected his resistance. She believed that this was how adults should behave, and she was extremely unhappy about it. She bent her will to the task of not feeling overweight and starving herself. It didn't help that she was sick of lunch and dinner and wanted only picnics, wanted baguettes, white peaches, dry chèvre, and coffee. She was sick of watching Brian enjoy a meal. She hated Robin for having a husband she could trust. She hated Robin for her rudeness at Cape May. She cursed Robin in her head, called Robin a cunt, and threatened to fuck her husband. Several nights after dinner, she considered violating her own twisted ethics and putting the moves on Brian, because surely he would defer to her judgment. Surely, given permission, he would jump up on her bed and pant and grin and lick her hand. But she was finally too demoralized by her hair and clothes. She was ready to go home. 2 nights before they left, she knocked on Brian's door before dinner, and he pulled her into his room and kissed her. He'd given no warning of his change of heart. She visited the confessor in her head and was able to say, "Nothing, I did nothing, I knocked on the door, and next thing I know he's on his knees." On his knees, he pressed her hands to his face. She looked at him as she'd looked at Don Armour long ago. His desire brought cool, topical relief to the dryness and crackedness, the body-wide distress of her person. She followed him to bed. Naturally, being good at everything, Brian knew how to kiss. He had the oblique style she liked. She murmured ambiguously, "I love your taste." He put his hands everywhere she'd expected him to put them.
She unbuttoned his shirt as the woman does at a certain point. She licked his nipple in the nodding, firm way of a grooming cat. She put a practiced, curled hand on the lump in his pants. She was beautifully, avidly adulterous, and she knew it. She embarked on buckle work, on hook-and-button projects, on elastic band labors, until they began to swell inside her, hardly noticeable and then suddenly distinct, and then not merely distinct but increasingly painful in its pressure on her peritoneum and eyeballs and arteries and meninges, a body-sized, robin-faced balloon of wrongness. Brian's voice was in her ear. He was asking the protection question. He'd mistaken her discomfort for transports, her squirming for an invitation. She clarified by rolling out of bed and crouching in a corner of the hotel room. She said she couldn't. Brian sat up on the bed and made no reply. She stole a glance and confirmed that his endowment was per expectation for the man who had everything. She suspected that she wouldn't soon forget the sight of this dick, would be seeing it when she closed her eyes, at inconvenient times, in far-fetched contexts. She apologized to him.
"No, you're right," Brian said, deferring to her judgment. "I feel terrible. I've never done anything like this."
"See, I have," she said, lest he think her merely timid. "More than once, and I don't want to any more."
"No, of course, you're right. If you weren't married, if I weren't your employee... Listen, I'm dealing with it. I'm going in the bathroom now. I'm dealing with it."
"Thank you."
Part of her thought,
"What is my problem?"
Another part of her thought, "For once in my life, I'm doing the right thing." She spent 4 nights by herself in Alsace and flew home from Frankfurt. She was shocked when she went to see the progress that Brian's team had made at the generator in her absence. The building within a building was already framed out, the concrete subfloors poured. She could see what the effect would be, a bright bubble of modernity in a twilight of monumental industry. Although she had faith in her cooking, the grandness of the space made her nervous. She wished that she'd insisted on an ordinary, plain space in which her food could shine alone. She felt seduced and suckered somehow, as if, unbeknownst to her, Brian had been competing with her for the world's attention. As if all along, in his affable way, he'd been angling to make the restaurant his, not hers. She was haunted, just as she'd feared, by the after-image of his dick. She felt gladder and gladder that she hadn't let him put it in her. Brian had every advantage that she had, plus many of his own. He was male, he was rich, he was a born insider. He wasn't hampered by Lambert weirdnesses or strong opinions. He was an amateur with nothing to lose but throw away money, and to succeed all he needed was a good idea and somebody else, namely her, to do the hard work. How lucky she'd been in that hotel room to recognize him as her adversary. 2 more minutes, and she would have disappeared. She would have become another facet of his really fun life. Her beauty reflecting on his irresistibility, her talents redounding to his restaurant's glory. How lucky she'd been. How lucky. She believed that if, when the generator opened, reviewers paid more attention to the space than to the food, she would lose and Brian would win. And so she worked her ass off. She convection-roasted country ribs to brownness and cut them thin along the grain for presentation, reduced and darkened the kraut gravy to bring out its nutty, earthy, cabbagey, porky flavor, and arted up the plate with twin testicular new potatoes, a cluster of Brussels sprouts, and a spoon of stewed white beans that she lightly spiked with roasted garlic. She invented luxurious new white sausages. She matched a fennel relish, roasted potatoes, and good, bitter, wholesome rapini with fabulous pork chops that she bought direct from a 60s holdover organic farmer who did his own butchering and made his own deliveries. She took the guy to lunch and visited his farm in Lancaster County and met the hogs in question, examined their eclectic diet, boiled yams and chicken wings, acorns and chestnuts,
and toured the soundproofed room where they were slaughtered. She extracted commitments from her old crew at Mare Scuro. She took former colleagues out on Brian's Amex and sized up the local competition, most of it reassuringly undistinguished, and sampled desserts to see if anybody's pastry chef was worth stealing. She staged one-woman late-night force meat festivals. She made sauerkraut in 5-gallon buckets in her basement. She made it with red cabbage and with shredded kale in cabbage juice, with juniper berries and black peppercorns. She hurried along the fermentation with 100-watt bulbs. Brian still called her every day, but he didn't take her driving in his Volvo anymore. He didn't play her music. Behind his polite questions, she sensed a waning interest. She recommended an old friend of hers, Rob Zito, to manage the generator, and when Brian took the two of them to lunch, he stayed for half an hour. He had an appointment in New York. One night Denise called him at home and instead got Robin Passafaro. Robin's clipped phrases, "Okay, whatever. Yes, I'll tell him. Okay." So irritated Denise that she deliberately kept her on the line. She asked how the garden project was going.
"Fine," Robin said. "I'll tell Brian you called."
"Could I come over sometime and see it?" Robin replied with naked rudeness.
"Why?"
"Well," Denise said, "it's something Brian talks about." This was a lie. He rarely mentioned it. "It's an interesting project. In fact, it sounded utopian and crackpot. And, you know, I love vegetables."
"Uh-huh."
"So maybe some Saturday afternoon or something?"
"Whenever."
A moment later, Denise slammed the phone down in its cradle. She was angry, among other things, at how fake she'd sounded to herself.
"I could have fucked your husband," she said, "and I chose not to, so how about a little friendliness?"
Maybe if she'd been a better person, she would have left Robin alone.
Maybe she wanted to make Robin like her, simply to deny her the satisfaction of disliking her, to win that contest of esteem. Maybe she was just picking up the gauntlet. But the desire to be liked was real. She was haunted by the feeling that Robin had been in the hotel room with her and Brian, by that bursting sensation of Robin's presence inside her body. On the last Saturday of baseball season, she cooked at home for 8 hours, shrink-wrapping trout, juggling half a dozen kraut salads, and pairing the pan juices of sautéed kidneys with interesting spirits. Late in the day she went for a walk and, finding herself going west, crossed Broad Street into the ghetto of Point Breeze, where Robin had her project. The weather was fine. Early autumn in Philadelphia brought smells of fresh seawater and tidewater, gradual abatements in temperature, a quiet abdication of control by the humid air masses that had held the onshore breeze at bay all summer. Denise passed an old woman in a housecoat standing watch while two dusty men unloaded Acme groceries from a corroded Pinto's hatchback. Cinder block was the material of choice over here for blinding windows. There were fire-gutted luncheonettes and pizzerias, friable houses with bedsheet curtains, expanses of fresh asphalt that seemed to seal the neighborhood's fate more than promise renewal. Denise didn't care if she saw Robin. Almost better, in a way, to score the point subtly, to let Robin find out from Brian that she'd taken the trouble to walk by the project. She came to a block within whose chain-link confines were small hills of mulch and large piles of wilted vegetation. At the far corner of the block, behind the only house left standing on it, somebody was working rocky soil with a shovel. The front door of the solitary house was open. A black girl of college age was sitting at a desk that also contained a vastly ghastly plaid sofa and a wheeled blackboard on which a column of names, Letitia, Latoya, Terrell, was followed by columns of hours to date and dollars to date. "Looking for Robin," Denise said. The girl nodded at the open rear door of the house. "She's in back." The garden was raw but peaceful. Not much seemed to have been grown here besides squashes and their cousins, but the patches of vine were extensive, and the smells of mulch and dirt and the onshore autumn breeze were full of childhood memory. Robin was shoveling rubble into a makeshift sieve.
She had thin arms and a hummingbird metabolism and took many fast, small bites of rubble instead of fewer big ones. She was wearing a black bandana and a very dirty T-shirt with the text, "Quality Daycare, Pay Now or Pay Later." She seemed neither surprised nor pleased to see Denise.
"This is a big project," Denise said.
Robin shrugged, holding the shovel with both hands, as if to stress that she felt interrupted.
"Do you want some help?" Denise said.
"No. The kids were supposed to do this, but there's a game over at the river. I'm just cleaning up."
She whacked the rubble in the sieve to urge some dirt through. Caught in the mesh were fragments of brick and mortar, gobs of roofing tar, ailanthus limbs, petrified cat shit, Bacardi and Yuengling labels with backings of broken glass.
"So, what did you grow?" Denise said.
Robin shrugged again.
"Nothing that would impress you."
"Well, like what?"
"Like zucchini and pumpkins."
"I cook with both of those."
"Yeah."
"Who's the girl?"
"I have a couple of half-time assistants that I pay. Sarah's a junior at Temple."
"And who are the kids who were supposed to be here?"
"Neighborhood kids between 12 and 16.
Robin took off her glasses and rubbed sweat from her face with a dirty sleeve. Denise had forgotten, or had never noticed to begin with, what a pretty mouth she had.
"They get minimum wage plus vegetables plus a share of any money we make."
"Do you subtract expenses?"
"That would discourage them."
"Right."
Robin looked away, across the street, at a row of dead buildings with rusting sheet metal cornices.
"Brian says you're very competitive."
"Oh, really?"
"He said he wouldn't want to arm wrestle you."
Denise winced.
"He said he wouldn't want to be the other chef in the kitchen with you."
"No danger of that," Denise said.
"He said he wouldn't want to play Scrabble with you."
"Uh-huh."
"He said he wouldn't want to play Trivial Pursuit with you."
"Okay, okay," Denise thought.
Robin was breathing hard.
"Anyway."
"Yeah, anyway."
"Here's why I didn't go to Paris," Robin said. "I thought Erin was too young. Sinead was having fun at art camp, and I had tons of work here."
"I understood that."
"And you guys were going to be talking about food all day, and Brian said it was business, so..."
Denise raised her eyes from the dirt, but couldn't quite look Robin in the eye.
"It was business."
Robin, her lip trembling, said,
"Whatever."
Above the ghetto, a fleet of copper-bottomed clouds, revere-ware clouds, had withdrawn to the northwest. It was the moment when the blue backdrop of the sky grayed to the same value as the stratus formations in front of it, when nightlight and daylight were in equilibrium.
"You know, I'm not really into guys," Denise said.
"Pardon me?"
"I said I don't sleep with men anymore since I got divorced."
Robin frowned as if this made no sense to her at all.
"Does Brian know that?"
"I don't know. Not from my telling him."
Robin thought this over for a moment and then began to laugh. She said, "She said, ha ha ha." Her laugh was full-throated and embarrassing and at the same time, Denise thought, lovely. It echoed off the rusty corniced houses.
"Poor Brian," she said. "Poor Brian."
Robin immediately became more cordial. She put down her shovel and gave Denise a tour of the garden.
"My little enchanted kingdom," she called it.
Finding that she had Denise's interest, she risked enthusiasm. Here was a new asparagus patch. Here, two rows of young pear and apple trees that she hoped to espalier. Here, the late crops of sunflowers, acorn squash, and kale. She'd planted only sure winners this summer, hoping to hook a core group of local teenagers and reward them for the thankless infrastructural work of preparing beds, running pipes, adjusting drainages, and connecting rain barrels to the roof of the house.
"This is basically a selfish project," Robin said. "I always wanted a big garden, and now the whole inner city is going back to farmland.
But the kids who really need to be out working with their hands and learning what fresh food tastes like are the ones who aren't doing it. They're latchkey kids. They're getting high, they're having sex, or they're stuck in some classroom until six with the computer. But they're also at an age when it's still fun to play in the dirt. Though possibly not as much fun as sex or drugs. Maybe not for 90% of kids, Robin said. I just want there to be something for the other 10%, some alternative that doesn't involve computers. I want Sinead and Erin to be around kids who aren't like them. I want them to learn how to work. I want them to know that work isn't just pointing and clicking. This is very admirable, Denise said. Robin, mistaking her tone, said, whatever. Denise sat on the plastic skin of a bale of peat moss while Robin washed up and changed her clothes. Maybe it was because she could count on one hand the autumn Saturday evenings that she'd spent outside a kitchen since she was 20, or maybe because some sentimental part of her was taken in by the egalitarian ideal that Klaus von Kippel found so phony in St. Jude. But the word she wanted to apply to Robin Passafaro, who had lived in urban Philly all her life, was Midwestern, by which she meant hopeful or enthusiastic or community-spirited. She didn't care so much, after all, about being liked. She found herself liking. When Robin came out and locked the house, Denise asked if she had time for dinner. "Brian and his dad took the girls to see the Phillies," Robin said. "They'll come home full of stadium food, so sure, we can have dinner." "I have stuff in my kitchen," Denise said. "Do you mind?" "Anything, whatever." Typically, if a chef invited you to dinner, you considered yourself lucky and you hastened to show it. But Robin seemed determined not to be impressed. Night had fallen. The air on Catherine Street smelled like the last weekend of baseball. Walking east, Robin told Denise the story of her brother, Billy. Denise had already heard the story from Brian, but parts of Robin's version were new to her. "So wait," she said. "Brian sold his company to W, and then Billy attacked one of W's vice presidents, and you think there's a connection?"
"God, yes," Robin said. "That's what's so horrible."
Brian didn't mention that part. Shrillness came pouring out of Robin.
"I can't believe it. That's the whole point. God, it is so like him not to mention that part. Because that part might actually make things hard for him, you know, the way things are hard for me. It might get in the way of his fun time in Paris, or his lunch date with Harvey Keitel, or whatever. I can't believe he didn't mention it."
"Explain to me what the problem is."
"Rick Flamberg's disabled for life," Robin said.